She pulled it out and then twisted it, pinching inward at the same time. Blood first welled between lip and gum, then gushed down her chin. She turned and left without speaking a word, before his stunned mind could persuade itself that he had really seen her do that. She closed the door and locked it. He heard her thud slushing her way down the hall to the parlor. He heard the creak of her favorite chair as she sat down. Nothing else. No TV, no singing, no click-clink of silver or crockery. No, she was just sitting there being not all right. Then there was a sound. It was not repeated, but it was utterly distinctive. It was a slap, a damned hard one. And since he was in here on one side of a locked door, and she was out there on the other side of it, didn't have to be Sherlock Holmes to figure out that she'd slapped herself. Good and hard from the sound. He saw her pulling her lip out, digging her short nails into her sensitive pink meat. He suddenly remembered a note on mental illness he had taken for the first misery book, where much of the action had been set in London's Bedlam Hospital. Misery had been railroaded there by the madly jealous villainess. When a manic depressive personality begins to slide deeply into a depressive period, he had written, one symptom he or she may exhibit is acts of self-punishment. Slapping, punching, pinching, burning oneself with cigarette butts, etc. He was suddenly very scared. Paul remembered an essay by Edmund Wilson, where Wilson had said, in typically grudging Wilson manner, that Wordsworth's criterion for the writing of good poetry, strong emotion recalled in a time of tranquility, would do well enough for most dramatic fiction as well. It was probably true. Paul had known writers who found it impossible to write after so much as a minor marital spat, and he himself usually found it impossible to write when upset. But there were times when a kind of reverse effect obtained. These were times when he had gone to the work not just because the work ought to be done, but because it was a way to escape whatever was upsetting him. These were usually occasions when rectifying the source of the upset was beyond him. This was one of those occasions. When she still hadn't returned to put him in his chair by 11 that morning, he determined to get into it by himself. Getting the typewriter off the mantel would be beyond him, but he could write longhand. He was sure he could hoist himself into the chair, knew it was probably a bad idea to let Annie know he could, but he needed his other fix, goddammit, and he could not write lying here in bed. He worked himself over to the edge of the bed, made sure the wheelchair brake was on, then grasped its arms and pulled himself slowly into the seat. Pulling his legs up onto the supports one at a time was the only part that hurt. He rolled himself over to the window and picked up his manuscript. The key rattled in the lock. Annie was looking in at him. Her eyes burned black holes in her face. Her right cheek was swelling up, and it looked like she was going to have a hell of a shiner in the morning. There was red stuff around her mouth and on her chin. For a moment, Paul thought it was more blood from her torn lip, and then he saw the seeds in it. It was raspberry jam or raspberry filling, not blood. She looked at him. Paul looked back. Neither said anything for a time. Outside, the first drops of rain splattered against the window. If you can get into that chair all by yourself, Paul, she said at last, then I think you can fill in your own fucking ends. She then closed the door and locked it again. Paul sat looking at it for a long time, almost as if there was something to see. He was too flabbergasted to do anything else. He didn't see her again until late afternoon. After her visit, work was impossible. He made a couple of futile tries, wadded up the paper, and gave up. It was a bust. He rolled himself back across the room. In the process of getting out of the chair and into bed, one of his hands slipped and he came within an ace of falling. He brought his left leg down, and although it took his weight and saved him from the fall, the pain was excruciating. It felt as if a dozen bolts had suddenly been driven into the bone. He screamed, scrabbled for the headboard, and pulled himself safely over onto the bed, his throbbing left leg trailing behind the rest of him. That will bring her, he thought incoherently. She'll want to see if Sheldon really turned into Luciano Pavarotti, or if it just sounds that way. But she didn't come, and there was no way he could bear the rotted ache in his left leg. He rolled clumsily onto his stomach, burrowed one arm deep under the mattress, and brought out one of the Novril sample cards. He dry-swallowed two, then drifted for a while. When he came back, he thought at first he must still be dreaming. It was just too surreal, like the night when she rolled the barbecue pot in here. Annie was sitting on the side of his bed. She had set a water glass filled with Novril capsules on his bed table. In her other hand, she had a Victor rat trap. There was a rat in it, too. A large one with mottled gray-brown fur. The trap had broken the rat's back. Its rear feet hung over the sides of the trap's board, twitching randomly. There were beads of blood in its whiskers. This was no dream. Just another day lost in the funhouse with Annie. Her breath smelled like a corpse decomposing in rotted food. Annie? He straightened up, his eyes moving between her and the rat. Outside it was dusk, a strange blue dusk filled with rain. It sheeted against the window. Strong gusts of wind shook the house, making it creak. Whatever had been wrong with her this morning was worse tonight, much worse. He realized he was seeing her with all her masks put aside. This was the real Annie, the inside Annie. The flesh of her face, which had previously seemed so fearsomely solid, now hung like lifeless dough. Her eyes were blanks. She had dressed, but her skirt was on inside out. There were more wheels on her flesh, more furrows. When she moved, they exhaled too many different aromas for Paul to count. Nearly one whole arm of her cardigan sweater was soaked with a half-dried substance that smelled like gravy. She held up the trap. They come into the cellar when it rains. The pinned rat squeaked feebly and snapped at the air. Its black eyes, infinitely more lively than those of its captor, rolled. I put down traps. I have to. I smear the triplets with bacon grease. I always catch 8 or 9. Sometimes I find others. She blanked then. Blanked for nearly 3 minutes, holding the rat in the air, a perfect case of waxy catatonia. Paul stared at her, stared at the rat as it squeaked and struggled, and realized that he had actually believed that things could get no worse. Untrue. Unfucking true. At last, as he had begun to think she had just sailed off into oblivion forever with no fuss or fanfare, she lowered the trap and went on as if she had never stopped speaking. Drowned in the corners. Poor things. She looked down at the rat. A tear fell onto its matted fur. Poor, poor things. She closed one of her strong hands around the rat and pulled back the spring with the other. It lashed in her hand, head twisting as it tried to bite her. Its squeals were thin and terrible. Paul pressed the heel of a palm against his wincing mouth. How its heart beats. How it struggles to get away. As we do, Paul. As we do. We think we know so much. But we really don't know any more than a rat in a trap. A rat with a broken back that thinks it still wants to live. The hand holding the rat became a fist. Her eyes never lost that blank, distant cast. Paul wanted to look away and could not. Tendons began to stand out on her inner arm. Blood ran from the rat's mouth in an abrupt, thin stream. Paul heard its bones break, and then the thick pads of her fingers punched into its body, disappearing up to the first. Blood pattered on the floor. The creature's dulling eyes bulged. She tossed the body into the corner and wiped her hand indifferently on the sheet, leaving long red smears. Now it's at peace. She shrugged, then laughed. I'll get my gun, Paul, shall I? Maybe the next world is better. For rats and people both. Not that there's much difference between the two. Not until I finish, he said, trying to enunciate each word carefully. This was difficult, because he felt as if someone had shot his mouth full of Novocaine. He had seen her low before, but he'd seen nothing like this. He wondered if she'd ever had a low as this before shooting all themselves. How to despair of a woman who dresses her children in their best, takes them out for him, walks them down to the lifts one into the crook of each arm, and jumps over the side. Depressives kill themselves. Psychotics, rocked in the poison cradles of their own egos, want to do everyone handy a favor and take them along. I'm closer to death than I've ever been in my life, he thought, because she means it. The bitch means it. Misery? She asked, almost as if she had never heard the word before. But there had been a momentary fugitive sparkle in her eyes, hadn't there? He thought so. Misery, yes. He thought desperately about how he should go on. Every possible approach seemed mined. I agree that the world is a pretty crappy place most of the time, he said, and then added inanely, especially when it rains. Oh, you idiot. Stop babbling. I mean, I've been in a lot of pain these last few weeks, and... Pain? She looked at him with sallow, sunken contempt. You don't know what pain is. You haven't the slightest idea, Paul. No, I suppose not. Not compared to you. That's right. But I want to finish this book. I want to see how it all turns out. He paused. And I'd like you to stick around and see, too. A person might as well not write a book at all if there's no one around to read it. Do you get me? He lay there looking at that terrible stone face, heart thumping. Annie, do you get me? Yes, she sighed. I do want to know how it comes out. That's the only thing left in the world that I still want, I suppose. Slowly, apparently unaware of what she was doing, she began to suck the rat's blood from her fingers. Paul jammed his teeth together and grimly told himself he would not vomit. Would not. It's like waiting for the end of those chapter plays. She looked around suddenly, the blood on her mouth like lipstick. Let me offer again, Paul. I can get my gun. I can end all of this for both of us. You are not a stupid man. I can't let you leave here. You've known that for some time, haven't you? Don't let your eyes waver. If she sees your eyes waver, she'll kill you right now. Yes. But it always ends, doesn't it, Annie? In the end, we all swing. A ghost of a smile at the corners of her mouth. She touched his face briefly, with some affection. I suppose you think of escape. So does a rat in a trap, I'm sure, in its way. But you're not going to, Paul. You might if this was one of your stories, but it's not. I can't let you leave here. But I could go with you. And suddenly, for just a moment, he thought of saying, All right, Annie, go ahead. Let's just call it off. Then his need and will to live, and there was still quite a lot of it in him, rose up and clamored the momentary weakness away. Weakness was what it was. Weakness and cowardice. Fortunately or unfortunately, he did not have the crutch of mental illness to fall back on. Thank you, he said. But I want to finish what I've started. She sighed and stood up. All right. I suppose I must have known you would, because I see I brought you some pills, although I don't remember doing it. She laughed, a small, crazy titter which seemed to come from that slack face as if by ventriloquism. I'll have to go away for a while. If I don't, what you or I want won't matter. Because I do things. I have a place I go when I feel like this. A place in the hills. Did you ever read the Uncle Remus stories, Paul? He nodded. You remember Br'er Rabbit telling Br'er Fox about his laughing place? Yes. That's what I call my place up country. My laughing place. Remember how I said I was coming back from Sidewinder when I found you? He nodded. Well, that was a fib. I fibbed because I didn't know you well then. I was really coming back from my laughing place. It has a sign over the door that says that. Annie's Laughing Place, it says. Sometimes I do laugh when I go there. But mostly I just scream. How long will you be gone, Annie? She was drifting dreamily toward the door now. I can't tell. I brought you pills. You'll be all right. Take 2 every 6 hours, or 6 every 4 hours, or all of them at once. But what will I eat? He wanted to ask her and didn't. He didn't want her attention to return to him. Not at all. He wanted her gone. Being here with her was like being with the angel of death. He lay stiffly in his bed for a long time, listening to her movements, first upstairs and then on the stairs, then in the kitchen, fully expecting her to change her mind and come back with a gun after all. He did not even relax when he heard the side door slam and lock, followed by splashing steps outside. The gun could just as easily be in the Cherokee. Old Bessie's motor whirred and caught. Annie gunned it fiercely. A fan of headlights came on, illuminating a shiny silver curtain of rain. The lights began to retreat down the driveway. They swung around, dimming, and then Annie was gone. This time she was not headed downhill toward Sidewinder, but up into the high country. Go into her laughing place, Paul croaked, and began to laugh himself. She had hers. He was already in his. The wild gales of mirth ended when he looked at the mangled body of the rat in the corner. A thought struck him. Who said she didn't leave me anything to eat? He asked the room, and laughed even harder. In the empty house, Paul Sheldon's laughing place sounded like the padded cell of a madman. Two hours later, Paul jimmied the bedroom's lock again and for the second time forced the wheelchair through the doorway that was almost too small. For the last time, he hoped. He had a pair of blankets in his lap. All the pills he had cached under the mattress were wrapped in a Kleenex tucked into his underwear. He meant to get out if he could, rain or no rain. This was his chance, and this time he meant to take it. Sidewinder was downhill and the road would be slippery in the rain, and it was darker than a mine shaft. He meant to try it all the same. He hadn't lived the life of a hero or a saint, but he did not intend to die like an exotic bird in a zoo. He vaguely remembered an evening he'd spent drinking scotch with a gloomy playwright named Bernstein at the Lion's Head, down in the village. And if he lived to see the village again, he would get down on whatever remained of his knees and kiss the grimy sidewalk of Christopher Street. At some point, the conversation had turned to the Jews living in Germany, during the uneasy 4 or 5 years before the Wehrmacht rolled into Poland and the festivities began in earnest. Paul remembered telling Bernstein, who had lost an aunt and a grandfather in the Holocaust, that he didn't understand why the Jews in Germany, hell all over Europe, but especially in Germany, hadn't gotten out while there was still time. They were not, by and large, stupid people, and many had had a first-hand experience of such persecution. Surely they had seen what was coming. So why had they stayed? Bernstein's answer had struck him as frivolous and cruel and incomprehensible. Most of them had pianos. We Jews are very partial to the piano. When you own a piano, it's harder to think about moving. Now he understood. Yes. At first it was his broken legs and crushed pelvis. Then, God help him, the book had taken off. In a crazy way, he was even having fun with it. It would be easy, too easy, to blame everything on his broken bones or the dope, when in fact so much of it had been the book. That and the droning passage of days and their simple convalescent pattern. Those things, but mostly the stupid goddamn book, had been his piano. What would she do if he was gone when she came back from her laughing place? Burn the manuscript? I don't give a fuck, he said. And this was almost the truth. If he lived, he could write another book, recreate this one even if he wanted to. But a dead man couldn't write a book any more than he could buy a new piano. He went into the parlor. It had been tidy before, but now there were dirty dishes stacked on every available surface. It looked to Paul as if everyone in the house must be here. Annie apparently not only pinched and slapped herself when she was feeling depressed. It looked like she really... And never mind cleaning up after. He half remembered the stinking wind that had blown down his throat during the time in the cloud, and felt his stomach clench. Most of the remains were of sweet things. Ice cream had dried or was drying in many of the bowls and soup dishes. There were crumbs of cake and smears of pie on the plates. A mound of lime jello, covered with a cracked glaze of dried whipped cream, stood on top of the TV, next to a 2-liter plastic bottle of Pepsi and a gravy boat. The Pepsi bottle looked almost as big as the nose cone of a Titan II rocket. Its surface was dull and smeary, almost opaque. He guessed she had drunk directly from it, and that her fingers had been covered with gravy or ice cream when she did it. He had not heard the clink of silverware, and that was not surprising, because there was none here. Dishes and bowls and plates, but no cutlery. He saw drying drips and splashes, again mostly of ice cream, on the rug and couch. That was what I saw in her housecoat, the stuff she was eating, and what was on her breath. His image of Annie as piltdown woman recurred. He saw her sitting in here and scooping ice cream into her mouth, or maybe handfuls of half-congealed chicken gravy with a Pepsi chaser, simply eating and drinking in a deep, depressed daze. The penguin sitting in its block of ice was still on the knick-knack table, but she had thrown many of the other ceramic pieces into the corner, where their littered remains were scattered. Sharp little hooks and shards. He kept seeing her fingers as they sank into the rat's body, the red smears of her fingers on the sheet. He kept seeing her licking the blood from her fingers, doing it absently as she must have eaten the ice cream and jello and soft black jelly roll cake. These images were terrible, but they were a wonderful incentive to hurry. The spray of dried flowers on the coffee table had overturned. Beneath the table, barely visible, lay a dish of crusted custard pudding and a large book. Memory Lane, it said. Trips down memory lane when you're feeling depressed are never a very good idea, Annie. But I suppose you know that by this point in your life. He rolled across the room. Straight ahead was the kitchen. On the right, a wide, short hallway went down to Annie's front door. Beside this hallway, a flight of stairs went up to the second floor. Giving the stairs only a brief glance, there were drips of ice cream on some of the carpeted stair levels and glazy smears of it on the banister. Paul rolled down to the door. He thought that if there was going to be a way out for him, tied to his chair as he was, it would be by way of the kitchen door, the one she galloped from when Mr. Rancho Grande showed up. But he ought to check this one. He might get a surprise. He didn't. The porch stairs were every bit as steep as he had feared. But even if there had been a wheelchair ramp, a possibility he never would have accepted in a spirited game of Can You, even if a friend had suggested it, he couldn't have used it. There were 3 locks on the door. The police bar he could have coped with. The other 2 were Krieg's, the best locks in the whole world, according to his ex-cop friend Tom Twyford. And where were the keys? Let me see. On their way to Annie's laughing place, maybe? Yes, sirree, Bob. Give that man a cigar and a blowtorch to light it with. He reversed down the hall, fighting panic, reminding himself he hadn't expected much from the front door anyway. He pivoted the chair once he was in the parlor and rolled into the kitchen. This was an old-fashioned room with bright linoleum on the floor and a pressed tin ceiling. The refrigerator was old but quiet. There were three or four magnets stuck to its door. Not surprisingly, they all looked like candy. A piece of bubble gum, a Hershey bar, a Tootsie Roll. One of the cabinet doors was open, and he could see shelves neatly covered with oilcloth. There were big windows over the sink, and they would let in a lot of light even on cloudy days. It should have been a cheery kitchen, but wasn't. The garbage can overflowed onto the floor and emitted the warm reek of spoiling food. But that wasn't the only thing wrong, or the worst smell. There was another that seemed to exist mostly in his mind, but which was no less real for that. It was Parfum de Wilkes, a psychic odor of obsession. There were three doors in the room, two to the left and one straight ahead, between the refrigerator and the pantry alcove. He went to those on the left first. One was the kitchen closet. He knew that even before he saw the coats, hats, scarves, and boots. The brief yapping squeak of the hinges was enough to tell him. The other was the one Annie used to go out. And here was another police bar and two more Kriegs. Roydman, stay out. Paul, stay in. He imagined her laughing. You fucking bitch! He struck his fist against the side of the door. It hurt, and he pressed the side of his hand against his mouth. He hated the sting of tears, the momentary doubling of his vision when he blinked, but there was no way he could stop it. The panic was yammering more loudly now, asking what he was going to do. What was he going to do, for Christ's sake? This might be his last chance. What I'm going to do first is a thorough job of checking the situation out, he told himself grimly. If you can stay cool for just a while longer, that is. Think you can do that, chicken shit? He wiped his eyes. Crying was not going to get him out of this. He looked out through the window which made up the top half of the door. It wasn't really just one window, but 16 small panes. He could break the glass in each, but he would have to bust the lathes, too, and that might take hours without a saw. They looked strong. And what then? A kamikaze dive out onto the back porch? A great idea. Maybe he could break his back, and that would take his mind off his legs for a while. And it wouldn't take long lying out there in the pelting rain before he died of exposure. That would take care of the whole rotten business. No way. No fucking way. Maybe I'm going to punch out, but I swear to God, I'm not going to do it until I get a chance to show my number one fan just how much I've enjoyed getting to know her. And that isn't just a promise. That's a sacred vow. The idea of paying Annie back did more to still his panic than any amount of self-scolding had done. A little calmer, he flicked the switch beside the locked door. It turned on an outside light, which came in handy. The last of the daylight had drained away during the time since he had left his room. Annie's driveway was flooded, and her yard was a quagmire of mud, standing water, and gobbets of melting snow. By positioning his wheelchair all the way to the left of the door, he could for the first time see the road which ran by her place, although it was really no big deal. Two-lane blacktop between decaying snowbanks, shiny as sealskin and awash with rainwater and snowmelt. Maybe she locked the doors to keep the Roydmans out, but she sure didn't need to lock them to keep me in. If I got out there in this wheelchair, I'd be bogged to the hubcaps in 5 seconds. You're not going anywhere, Paul. Not tonight. Probably not for weeks. There'll be a month into the baseball season before the ground firms up enough for you to get out to the road in this wheelchair. Unless you want to crash through a window and crawl. No, he didn't want to do that. It was too easy to imagine how his shattered bones would feel after 10 or 15 minutes of wriggling through cold puddles and melting snow like a dying tadpole. And even supposing he could make it out to the road, what were his chances of flagging down a car? The only two he'd ever heard out there other than old Bessie had been El Rancho Grande's Bel Air and the car which had scared the life out of him passing the house on the first occasion he had escaped his guest room. He turned off the outside light and rolled across to the other door, the one between the refrigerator and the pantry. There were three locks on this one as well, and it didn't even open on the outside, or at least not directly. There was another light switch beside this door. Paul flicked it and saw a neat shed addition, which ran the length of the house on its windward side. One was a woodpile and a chopping block with an axe buried in it. At the other was a work table and tools hung on pegs. To its left there was another door. The bulb out there wasn't terribly bright, but it was bright enough for him to see another police boat and another two Krieglocks on that door as well. The Roidmans. Everybody. All out to get me. I don't know about them, he said to the empty kitchen, but I sure am. Giving up on the doors, he rolled into the pantry. Before he looked at the food stored on the shelves, he looked at the matches. There were two cartons of paper book matches and at least two dozen boxes of diamond blue tips, neatly stacked up. For a moment, he considered simply lighting the place on fire, began to reject the idea as the most ridiculous yet, and then saw something which made him reconsider it briefly. In here was yet another door, and this one had no locks on it. He opened it and saw a set of steep, rickety stairs pitching and yawing their way into the cellar. An almost vicious smell of dampness and rotting vegetables rose from the dark. He heard low, squeaking sounds and thought of her saying, "They come into the cellar when it rains. I put down traps. I have to." He slammed the door shut in a hurry. A drop of sweat trickled down from his temple and ran stinging into the corner of his right eye. He knuckled it away. Knowing that door must lead to the cellar, and seeing that there were no locks on it, had made the idea of torching the place seem momentarily more rational. He could maybe shelter there. But the stairs were too steep. The possibility of being burned alive, if Annie's flaming house collapsed into the cellar hole, before the Sidewinder fire engines could get here, was too real. And the rats down there. The sound of the rats was somehow worse. How its heart beats. How it struggles to get away. As we do, Paul. As we do. Africa, Paul said, and didn't hear himself say it. He began to look at the cans and bags of food in the pantry, trying to assess what he could take with the least chance of raising her suspicions next time she came out here. Part of him understood exactly what this assessment meant. He had given up the idea of escape. Only for the time being, his troubled mind protested. No, a deeper voice responded implacably. Forever, Paul. Forever. I will never give up, he whispered. Do you hear me? Never. Oh, no, the voice of the cynic whispered sardonically. Well, we'll see, won't we? Yes, they would see. Larder, more like a survivalist's bomb shelter than a pantry. He guessed that some of this hoarding was a simple nod to the realities of her situation. She was a woman alone living in the high country, where a person must reasonably expect to spend a certain, maybe only a day, but sometimes as long as a week or even two, cut off from the rest of the world. Probably even those cock-a-doodle Roidmans had a pantry that would make a homeowner from another part of the country raise his or her brows. But he doubted if the cock-a-doodle Roidmans or anyone else up here had anything which came close to what he was now looking at. This was no pantry. This was a goddamn supermarket. He supposed there was a certain symbolism in Annie's pantry. The ranks of goods had something to say about the murkiness of the borderline between the sovereign state of reality and the People's Republic of Paranoia. In his current situation, however, such niceties hardly seemed worth examination. Fuck the symbolism. Go for the food. Yes, but be careful. It wasn't just a matter of what she might miss. He must take no more than he could reasonably hope to hide if she came back suddenly. And how else did he think she would come? Her phone was dead, and he somehow doubted if Annie would send him a telegram or flowers by wire. But in the end, what she might miss in here or find in his room hardly mattered. After all, he had to eat. He was hooked on that, too. Sardines. There were lots of sardines in those flat rectangular cans with a key under the paper. Good. He would have some of those. Tins of deviled ham. No keys, but he could open a couple of cans in her kitchen and eat those first. Bury the empties deep in her own overflowing garbage. There was an open package of sun-made raisins containing smaller boxes, which the ad copy on the torn cellophane wrapper called mini-snacks. Paul added four of the mini-snacks to the growing stash in his lap, plus single-serving boxes of cornflakes and Wheaties. He noted there had been no single-serving boxes of pre-sweetened cereals. If there had been, Annie had chowed them down on her last binge. On a higher shelf was a pile of Slim Jims, as neatly stacked as the kindling in Annie's shed. He took four, trying not to disturb the pyramidal structure of the pile, and he ate one of them greedily, relishing the salty taste and the grease. He tucked the wrapping into his underwear for later disposal. His legs were beginning to hurt. He decided that if he wasn't going to escape or burn the house down, he ought to go on back to his room. An anticlimax, but things could be worse. He could take a couple of pills and then write until he got drowsy. Then he could go to sleep. He doubted if she would be back tonight. Far from abating, the storm was gaining strength. The idea of writing quietly and then sleeping with the knowledge that he was perfectly alone, that Annie was not going to burst in with some wild idea or even wilder demand, held great appeal, anticlimax or not. He reversed out of the pantry, pausing to turn off the light, reminding himself that he must rinse, put everything back in order as he made his retreat. If he ran out of food before she came back, he could always return for more. Like a hungry rat, right, Polly? But he must not forget how careful he must be. It would not do to forget the simple fact that he was risking his life every time he left his room. Forgetting that would not do at all. As he was rolling across the parlor, the scrapbook under the coffee table caught his eye again. Memory Lane. It was as big as a folio Shakespeare play and as thick as a family Bible. Curious, he picked it up and opened it. On the first page was a single column of newsprint, headed Wilkes Berryman Nuptials. There was a picture of a pale gent with a narrow face and a woman with dark eyes and a pursy mouth. Paul glanced from the newspaper photo to the portrait over the mantel. No question. The woman identified in the clipping as Cressilda Berryman. Now there's a name worthy of a misery novel, he thought, was Annie's mother. Neatly written in black ink below the clipping was Bakersfield Journal, May 30th, 1938. Page 2 was a birth announcement. Paul Emery Wilkes, born in Bakersfield Receiving Hospital, May 12th, 1939. Father, Carl Wilkes, mother, Cressilda Wilkes. The name of Annie's older brother gave him a start. He must have been the one with whom she had gone to the movies and seen the chapter plays. Her brother had been Paul, too. Page 3 announced the birth of Anne Marie Wilkes, D.O.B., April 1, 1943, which made Annie just past her 44th birthday. The fact that she had been born on April Fool's Day did not escape Paul. Outside, the wind gusted. Rain tore against the house. Fascinated, his pain temporarily forgotten, Paul turned the page. The next clipping was from page 1 of the Bakersfield Journal. The photo showed a fireman on a ladder, silhouetted against the background of flames billowing from the windows of a frame building. 5 die in apartment house fire. 5 persons, 4 of them members of the same family, died in the early hours of Wednesday morning, victims of a smoky 3-alarm fire in a Bakersfield apartment house on Watch Hill Avenue. 3 of the dead were children. Paul Krenmutz, 8, Frederick Krenmutz, 6, and Allison Krenmutz, 3. The fourth was their father, Adrian Krenmutz, 41. Mr. Krenmutz rescued the surviving Krenmutz child, Laureen Krenmutz, who was 18 months old. According to Mrs. Jessica Krenmutz, her husband put the youngest of their 4 children in her arms and told her, "I'll be back with the others in a minute or two. Pray for us." "I never saw him again," she said. The fifth victim, Irving Thalman, 58, was a bachelor who lived on the top floor of the building. The third-floor apartment was vacant at the time of the fire. The Carl Wilkes family, at first listed as missing, left the building Tuesday night because of a water leak in the kitchen. "I weep for Mrs. Krenmutz and her loss," Cressilda Wilkes told a journal reporter, "but I thank God for sparing my husband and my own 2 children." Centralia Fire Chief Michael O'One said that the fire began in the apartment building's basement. When asked about the possibility of arson, he said, "It's more likely that a wino crept into the basement, had a few drinks, and accidentally started the fire with a cigarette. He probably ran instead of trying to put the fire out, and 5 people died. I hope we catch up with a bum." When asked about the leads, a one said, "The police have several, and they're following them up hard and fast, I can tell you." The same neat black ink below the clipping. October 28, 1954. Paul looked up. He was totally still, but a pulse beat rapidly in his throat. His bowels felt loose and hot. Little brats. 3 of the dead were children. Mrs. Krenmutz's 4 brats downstairs. Oh, no. Oh, Christ, no. I used to hate those little brats. She was just a kid. Not even in the house. She was 11. Old enough and bright enough maybe to spill some kerosene around a cheap liquor bottle, then light a candle and put the candle in the middle of the kerosene. Maybe she didn't even think it would work. Maybe she thought the kerosene would evaporate before the candle burned all the way down. Maybe she thought they'd get out alive, only wanted to scare them into moving. But she did it, Paul. She fucking did it, and you know it. Yes, he supposed he did. And who would suspect her? He turned the page. Here was yet another Bakersfield Journal clipping, this one dated July 19, 1957. It featured a picture of Carl Wilkes looking slightly older. One thing was clear. It was as old as he was ever going to get. The clipping was his obituary. Bakersfield accountant dies in freak fall. Carl Wilkes, a longtime Bakersfield resident, died shortly after being admitted to Hernandez General Hospital last night. He apparently stumbled over a pile of loose clothing, which had been left on the stairs earlier, while on his way down to answer the phone. Dr. Frank Canley, the admitting physician, said that Wilkes died of multiple skull fractures and a broken neck. He was 44. Wilkes is survived by his wife, Griselda, a son, Paul, 18, and a daughter, Anne, 14. When Paul turned to the next page, he thought for a moment that Annie had pasted in 2 copies of her father's obituary out of sentiment or by accident. He thought this latter the more likely possibility of the 2. But this was a different accident, and the reason for the similarity was simplicity itself. Neither had really been an accident at all. He felt stark and simple terror steal into him. The neat handwriting below this clipping read, "Los Angeles Call, January 29, 1962. USC student dies in freak fall." Andrea St. James, a USC nursing student, was pronounced dead on arrival at Mercy Hospital in North Los Angeles last night, the apparent victim of a bizarre accident. Miss St. James shared an off-campus apartment on DeLorme Street with a sister nursing student, Anne Wilkes of Bakersfield. Shortly before 11 p.m., Miss Wilkes heard a brief scream followed by terrible thudding sounds. Miss Wilkes, who had been studying, rushed onto the 3rd-floor landing and saw Miss St. James lying on the landing below, sprawled in a very unnatural position. Miss Wilkes said that in her effort to render aid, she almost fell herself. "We had a cat named Peter Gunn," she said. "Only we hadn't seen him for days and thought the pound must have gotten him because we kept forgetting to get him a tag. He was lying dead on the stairs. It was the cat she tripped over. I covered Andrea with my sweater and then called the hospital. I knew she was dead, but I didn't know who else to call." Miss St. James, a native of Los Angeles, was 21. Jesus. Paul whispered it over and over. His hand was shaking badly as he turned the page. Here was a call clipping which said that the stray cat the student nurses adopted had been poisoned. Peter Gunn. Cute name for a cat, Paul thought. The landlord had rats in his basement. Tenant complaints had resulted in a warning from the building inspectors the year before. The landlord had caused a ruckus at a subsequent city council meeting, which had been lively enough to get coverage in the papers. Annie would have known. Faced with a stiff fine by councilmen who didn't like being called names, the landlord had sown the cellar with poisoned bait. Cat eats poison. Cat languishes in cellar for 2 days. Cat then crawls as close to his mistresses as possible before expiring and killing one of said mistresses. An irony worthy of Paul Harvey. Paul Sheldon thought, and laughed wildly. I bet it made his daily newscast, too. Neat. Very neat. Except we know that Annie picked up some of the poisoned bait in the cellar and hand-fed it to the cat. And if old Peter Gunn didn't want to eat it, she probably rammed it down his gullet with a stick. When he was dead, she put him on the stairs and hoped it would work. Maybe she had a pretty good idea her roommate would come home tiddly. I wouldn't be a bit surprised. A dead cat, a heap of clothes. Same M.O., as Tom Twyford would say. But why, Annie? These clippings tell me everything but that. Why? In an act of self-preservation, part of his imagination had, over the last few weeks, actually become Annie. And it was now this Annie part that spoke up in its dry and uncontradictable voice. And while what it said was perfectly mad, it also made perfect sense. I killed her because she played her radio late at night. I killed her because of the dumb name she gave the cat. I killed her because I got tired of seeing her soul kissing her boyfriend on the couch, him with his hand shoved so far up her skirt he looked like he was prospecting for gold. I killed her because I caught her cheating. I killed her because she caught me cheating. The specifics don't matter, do they? I killed her because she was a cock-a-doodle brat, and that was reason enough. And maybe because she was a Mrs. Smart Guy, Paul whispered. He threw back his head and donkeyed another shrill and frightened laugh. So this was Memory Lane, was it? Oh, what a variety of strange and poisonous flowers grew beside Annie's version of that quaint old path. No one ever put those two freak falls together? First her father, then her roommate? Are you seriously telling me that? Yes, he was seriously telling himself that. The accidents had happened almost 5 years apart in two different towns. They'd been reported by different papers in a populous state where people were probably always falling downstairs and breaking their necks. And she was very, very clever. Almost as clever as Satan himself, it seemed. Only now she was starting to lose it. It would be precious little consolation to him, however, if Annie were to be finally brought to bay for the murder of Paul Sheldon. He turned the page and discovered another clipping from the Bakersfield Journal, the last, as it turned out. The headline read, "Miss Wilkes is nursing school graduate. Hometown girl makes good. May 17, 1966. The photo was of a younger, startlingly pretty Annie Wilkes, wearing a nurse's uniform and cap, smiling into the camera. It was a graduation photograph. Of course. She had graduated with honors. Only had to kill one roommate to do it, too, Paul thought, and donkeyed his shrill, frightened laugh. The wind gusted around the side of the house as if in answer. Mom's picture chattered briefly on the wall. The next cutting was from the Manchester, New Hampshire Union Leader, March 2, 1969. It was a simple obituary which seemed to have no connection with Annie Wilkes at all. Ernest Gagnier, age 79, had died in St. Joseph's Hospital. No exact cause of death given. After a long illness, the obit said. Survived by his wife, 12 children, and what looked like about 400 grandchildren and great-grandchildren. There was nothing like the rhythm method for producing all descendants great and small, Paul thought, and donkeyed again. She killed him. That's what happened to good old Ernie. Why else is his obituary here? This is Annie's Book of the Dead, isn't it? Why, for God's sake? Why? With Annie Wilkes, that is a question which has no sane answer, as you well know. Another page, another Union Leader obit. March 19, 1969. The lady was identified as Hester Queenie Bulifant, 84. In the picture, she looked like something whose bones might have been exhumed from the La Brea tar pits. The same thing that had gotten Ernie had gotten Queenie. Seemed like that long illness shit was going around. Like Ernie, she had expired at St. Joe's. Viewings at 2 and 6 p.m. on March 20th at Foster's Funeral Home. Interment at Mary Sire Cemetery on March 21st at 4 p.m. Ought to have had a special rendition of Annie, Won't You Come By Here, sung by the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, Paul thought, and did the donkey some more. There were three more Union Leader bits on the following pages. two old men who had died of that perennial favorite, long illness. The third was a woman of 46 named Paulette Simoe. Paulette had died of that common runner-up, short illness. Although the picture accompanying the obit was even grainier and fuzzier than usual, Paul saw that Paulette Simoe made Queenie Bulephant look like Thumbelina. He thought her illness might have been short indeed. A thunderclap coronary, say, followed by a trip to St. Joe's. Followed by what? Exactly what? He really didn't want to think about the specifics, but all three obits identified St. Joseph's as the place of expiration. And if we looked at the nurse's register from March 1969, would we find the name Wilkes? Friends, does a bear go cock-a-doody in the woods? This book, dear God, this book was so big. No more, please. I don't want to look at any more. I've got the idea. I'm going to put this book down exactly where I found it. And I'm going into my room. I guess I don't want to write after all. I think I'll just take an extra pill and go to bed. Call it nightmare insurance. But no farther down Annie's memory lane, if you please. Please, if you please. But his hands seemed to have a mind and a will of their own. They kept on turning the pages faster and faster. Two more brief death notices in the Union Leader, one in late September of 1969, one in early October. March 19th, 1970. This one was from the Harrisburg, Pennsylvania Herald, a back page. New hospital staff announced. There was a photo of a balding, bespectacled man who looked to Paul like the type of fellow who might eat boogers in secret. The article noted that in addition to the new publicity director, the balding, bespectacled fellow, 20 others had joined the staff of Riverview Hospital. Two doctors, 8 RNs, assorted kitchen staff, orderlies, and a janitor. Annie was one of the RNs. On the next page, Paul thought, I'm going to see a brief death notice for an elderly man or woman who expired at Riverview Hospital in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Correct. An old duffer who had died of that all-time favorite, long illness. Followed by an elderly man who had died of that perennial bridesmaid, short illness. Followed by a child of 3 who had fallen down a well, sustained grievous head injuries, and been brought to Riverview in a coma. Numbly, Paul continued to turn the pages while the wind and rain drove against the house. The pattern was inescapable. She got a job, killed some people, and moved on. Suddenly an image came, one from a dream his conscious mind had already forgotten, which thus gained the Delphic resonance of déjà vu. He saw Annie Wilkes in a long apron dress, her hair covered with a mob cap, and Annie, who looked like a nurse in London's Bedlam Hospital. She held a basket over one arm. She dipped into it, brought out sand and flung it into the upturned faces she passed. This was not the soothing sand of sleep, but poison sand. It was killing them. When it struck them, their faces went white, and the lines on the machines monitoring their precarious lives went flat. Maybe she killed the Krenmutz kids because they were brats, and her roommate. Maybe even her own father. But these others? But he knew. The Annie in him knew. Old and sick. All of them had been old and sick except Mrs. Simoe, and she must have been nothing but a vegetable when she came in. Mrs. Simoe and the kid who had fallen down the well. Annie had killed them because they were rats in a trap, he whispered. Poor things. Poor, poor things. Sure. That was it. In Annie's view, all the people in the world were divided into 3 groups. Brats, poor, poor things, and Annie. She had moved steadily westward. Harrisburg to Pittsburgh to Duluth to Fargo. Then in 1978 to Denver. In each case, the pattern was the same. A Welcome Aboard article in which Annie's name was mentioned among others. She had missed the Manchester Welcome Aboard, probably because, Paul guessed, she hadn't known that local newspapers printed such things. Then 2 or 3 unremarkable deaths. Following these, the cycle would... Until Denver, that was. At first, it seemed the same. There was the New Arrivals article, this time clipped from the in-house newspaper of Denver's receiving hospital, with Annie's name mentioned. The in-house paper was identified in Annie's neat hand as the Gurney. Great name for a hospital paper, Paul told the empty room. Surprised no one thought of calling it the stool sample. He donkeyed more terrified laughter, all unaware. Turned the page, and here was the first obit, cut from the Rocky Mountain News. Laura D. Rothberg, long illness, September 21st, 1978, Denver Receiving Hospital. Then the pattern broke wide open. The next page announced a wedding instead of a funeral. The photo showed Annie, not in her uniform, but in a white dress frothing with lace. Beside her, holding her hands in his, was a man named Ralph Dugan. Dugan was a physical therapist. Dugan Wilkes Nuptials, the clipping was headed. Rocky Mountain News, January 2, 1979. Dugan was quite unremarkable save for one thing. He looked like Annie's father. Paul thought if you shaved off Dugan's single-bar mustache, the resemblance would be just short of uncanny. The thickness of the remaining pages in Annie's book, and thought Ralph Dugan should have checked his horoscope. Whoops, make that horoscope. The day he proposed Annie. I think the chances are very good that somewhere up ahead in these unturned pages, I'm going to find a brief article about you. Some people have appointments in Samara. I think you may well have had one with a pile of laundry or a dead cat on a flight of stairs. A dead cat with a cute... The next clipping was the new arrivals from the Nederland News... Nederland was a small town just west of Boulder. Not all that far from here, Paul judged. For a moment, he couldn't find Annie in the short, name-filled clipping, and then realized he was looking for the wrong name. She was here, but had become part of a socio-sexual corporation called Mr. and Mrs. Ralph Dugan. Paul's head snapped up. Was that a car coming? No, just the wind. Surely the wind. He looked back down at Annie's book. Ralph Dugan had gone back to helping the lame, the halt, and the blind at Arapahoe County Hospital. Presumably Annie went back to that time-honored nurse's job of giving aid and comfort to the grievously wounded. Now the killing starts, he thought. The only real question is about Ralph. Does he come at the beginning, in the middle, or at the end? But he was wrong again. Instead of an obit, the next clipping showed a Xerox of a realtor's one-sheet. In the upper left corner of the ad was a photo of a house. Paul recognized it only by the attached barn. He had, after all, never seen the house itself from the outside. Beneath, in Annie's neat, firm hand, earnest money paid back March 3, 1979. Papers passed March 18, 1979. Retirement home? Paul doubted it. Summer place? No. They couldn't afford the luxury. So? Well, maybe it was just a fantasy, but try this. Maybe she really loves old Ralph Dugan. Maybe a year has passed and she still can't smell cock-a-doodle on him. Something has sure changed. There have been no obituaries since... He flicked back to see. Since Laura Rothberg in September 1978. She stopped killing around the same time she met Ralph. But that was then and this is now. Now the pressure is starting to build up again. The depressive interludes are coming back. She looks at the old people, the terminally ill. And she thinks about what poor, poor things they are. And maybe she thinks... It's this environment that's depressing me. The miles of tiled corridor and the smells and the squeak of crepe-soled shoes and the sounds of people in pain. If I could get out of this place, I'd be all right. So Ralph and Annie had apparently gone back to the land. He turned the page and blinked. Slashed into the bottom of the page was Aug 4-3rd, 1880. Fuck you. The paper, thick as it was, had torn in several places under the fury of the hand which had driven the pen. It was the divorces granted column from the Nederland paper, but he had to turn it over to make sure that Annie and Ralph were a part of it. She had pasted it in, upside down. Yes, here they were. Ralph and Ann Dugan. Grounds. Mental cruelty. Divorced after a short illness, Paul muttered, and again looked up, thinking he heard an approaching car. The wind. Only the wind. Still, he'd better get back to the safety of his room. It wasn't just the worsening pains in his leg. He was edging toward a state of terminal freakout. But he bent over the book again. In a weird way, it was just too good to put down. It was like a novel so disgusting you just have to finish it. Annie's marriage had been dissolved in a much more legal fashion than Paul had anticipated. It seemed fair to say that the divorce really had been after a short illness. A year and a half of wedded bliss wasn't all that much. They had bought a house in March, and that was not a step you took if you felt that your marriage was falling apart. What happened? Paul didn't know. He could have made up a story, but a story was all it would have been. Then he read the clipping again. He noticed something suggestive. Angela Ford from John Ford. Christian Frawley from Stanley Frawley. Dana McLaren from Lee McLaren. And Ralph Dugan from Ann Dugan. There's this American custom, right? No one talks about it much, but it's there. Men propose in the moonlight, women file in court. That's not always how it works, but usually that's it. So what tale does this grammatical structure have to tell? Angela's saying, slip out the back, Jack. Kirsten is saying, make a new plan, Stan. Dana is saying, drop off the key, Lee. And what was Ralph, the only man who's listed first in this column, saying? I think maybe he was saying, let me the hell out of here. Maybe he saw the dead cat on the stairs, Paul said. Next page. Another new arrivals article. This one was from the Boulder, Colorado Camera. There was a photograph of a dozen new staff members standing on the lawn of the Boulder Hospital. Annie was in the second row, her face a blank white circle under her cap with its black stripe. Another opening of another show. The date underneath was March 9th, 1981. She had retaken her maiden name. Boulder. That was where Annie really had gone crazy. He turned the pages faster and faster, his horror mounting. And the two thoughts which kept repeating were, why in God's name didn't they tip faster? And how in God's name did she slip through their fingers? May 10th, 1981, long illness. May 14th, 1981, long illness. May 23rd, long illness. June 9th, short illness. June 15th, short. June 16th, long. Short, long, long, short, long, long, short. The pages stuttered through his fingers. He could smell the faint odor of dried paper paste. Christ, how many did she kill? If it was right to equate each obituary pasted in this book with a murder, then her score was more than 30 people by the end of 1981, all without a single murmur from the authorities. Of course, most of the victims were old, the rest badly hurt, but still, you would think. In 1982, Annie had finally stumbled. The clipping from the January 14th camera showed her blank, stone-like face rendered in newsprint dots below a headline which read, New Head Maternity Ward Nurse Named. On January 29th, the nursery deaths had begun. Annie had chronicled the whole story in her meticulous way. Paul had no trouble following it. If the people after your hide had found this book, Annie, you would have been in jail or some asylum until the end of time. The first two infant deaths had not aroused suspicion. A story on one had mentioned severe birth defects. But babies, defective or not, weren't the same as old folks dying of renal failure, or car crash victims, brought in still somehow alive in spite of heads which were only half there, or steering wheel-sized holes in their gut. And then she had begun killing the healthy along with the damaged. He supposed that in her deepening psychotic spiral, she had begun to see all of them as poor, poor things. By mid-March of 1982, there had been 5 nursery deaths in the Boulder Hospital. A full-scale investigation was launched. On March 24th, the camera named the probable culprit as Tainted Formula. A reliable hospital source was cited, and Paul wondered if perhaps the source had not been Annie Wilkes herself. Another baby had died in April, 2 in May. then from the front page of the June 1st Denver Post. Head maternity nurse questioned on infant deaths. No charges made as yet, sheriff's office spokeswoman says. By Michael Leith. Ann Wilkes, the 39-year-old head nurse of the maternity ward at Boulder Hospital, is being questioned today about the deaths of 8 infants, deaths which have taken place over a span of some months. All of the deaths took place following Miss Wilkes' appointment.